Lawyer and victim advocate Dr. Judy Courton has spent years fighting for fair compensation for survivors. And she tells me she still has concerns about how the scheme will operate.
Proving sexual abuse is inherently problematic. You know, the majority of the time, there are no witnesses to sexual abuse. Now, with child sexual abuse, we have many other problems that come in. For example, it can take someone an average of 30-odd years before they're able to disclose the abuse, which may mean, of course, that the offender could be dead, the offender could be old and unwell and lost capacity, or they may have skipped the jurisdiction. So it is word against word. So it's inherently problematic to begin with. But that doesn't mean to say, of course, that it's too hard for this redress scheme to deal with.
Looking at the scope of the scheme, it says the sexual abuse needed to have occurred inside a participating state. Now, it's important to note that the federal government can compel the territories to opt in. But do you think a Commonwealth redress scheme can still work, even if it doesn't have the support of all the states?
Well, no, it can't work. What that would mean is that it's very inequitable. It is setting up a very inequitable system, and basically it's saying to one group of victims, you can just, you know, go and get lost.
The eligibility also extends to some survivors with a criminal record. So if they've been convicted of any sexual offences, they're not eligible for redress. And on top of that, other serious crimes for which they were sentenced to a custodial period of 5 or more years. Do you think that's fair?
This is obviously a very contentious and difficult area. But I have to say, we have many clients who, because of the shocking crimes that were committed against them as children, they did go off the rails. That, you know, for many people, that is their introduction to their own sexuality. Child sex crimes were often associated with severe physical violence, psychological assault as well. And many, many victims and survivors have gone off the rails and ended up in trouble with the police. To have such a blanket rule, I think, is quite discriminatory. I understand some of the arguments, but to punish a victim of child sexual abuse in that way is unjust.
Because the government has said it doesn't want to use taxpayer money to pay criminals. So do you acknowledge there is a chance the scheme's integrity could be compromised if it does do that?
Well, of course. But if somebody has committed a crime, that doesn't dictate the whole person. That doesn't say that that person is not also suffering from psychiatric harm from child sex crimes. So I think it's too black and white. I think there needs to be room for more discretion with those potential provisions in the legislation.
And of course, questions are going to be asked about who gets what. Decisions will be made by people being referred to as independent decision makers. Who should these people be?
One of my greatest concerns is exactly that. What is the application process, firstly, for these independent decision makers? What is the selection process? It could end up a bit like the existing Towards Healing process, which is the Catholic Church's national internal complaints process, where you have as many as 400 separate religious orders or dioceses, and at the same time you have as many as 400 different decision makers. Now, where's the consistency with the decision making between these people? How does one not include being subjective about it? How does one stay objective about it? There are so many concerns with the independent decision makers, and I really want to see a lot more material on the application and selection process of these people.
And can I ask you about this idea of a deed of release? So if a person accepts their offer of redress, they must release the responsible institutions from any liability for sexual abuse. Should they be forced to do that?
No. One of the huge problems we have at the moment, for victims, for example, who have a prior settlement, I'll stick with, say, as an example, the Catholic Church. Somebody has, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, has gone back to the institution where they were abused to try and get some justice. They were offered a pathetic amount of money, sometimes $20,000, $30,000, and they've had to sign a deed of release for those settlements, which means, of course, that when the law changes, they've signed away all their future legal rights. Now, this was discussed at length at the Royal Commission, and I would say that it is manifestly unjust for a person to sign away all future legal rights for such very, very low sums of compensation, such as $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, even $50,000. And this is exactly what victims will be asked to do or required to do with the National Redress Scheme. But an even greater concern is when a victim or survivor decides to apply for some compensation with this redress scheme, how are they going to know whether or not they have a viable legal claim? The many states in Australia now have abolished the statute of limitations, so time, bringing a claim within a certain number of years is no longer an issue. Many of the Catholic organisations or religious bodies now do have a proper entity that can be sued. So the first thing I would be checking was, do you have a viable claim in the courts? Because if they do, to sign a deed of release for even $80,000 or $100,000, they may well do much, much better if they had a viable claim in the courts.
So some victims are better off bypassing the scheme altogether and pursuing their case through the court system?
They will be. The problem is, how will they know that? You know, the legal landscape in this area is changing pretty dramatically, which is a great thing. And the individual applicant for this process, who's going to inform them that they may well have a case that could well go to the courts instead of having to accept the many, many limitations of a national redress scheme.
Now, most of the Royal Commission recommendations were adopted. Five of them weren't. And as a result, counselling will only be available to survivors, not family members. What's your view on that?
I understand the arguments. I understand the concerns about costs. But I have to say I disagree very, very strongly with that proposal. You cannot have in a family or with friends only the primary victim being impacted by this. It is intergenerational, and the impacts on family members, loved ones, the impacts are profound. You know, I think counselling and counselling support for secondary victims, it may need to be limited, for example, to family members or partners, but to completely isolate all secondary victims, I think, is a real blight on this scheme.
Lawyer and victim advocate, Dr. Judy Corden.